This episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered is brought to you by MTN Zambia.
There's no us without you, so we say thank you.
I'm really happy to say that in the studio with me today is, in a light that I'm sure you've never seen her in, is Miss Linda Kasonde, a prominent lawyer in Zambia and well-known in the region, an advocate for human rights, doing amazing work out there, human rights for me and you, men and women, and of course, the first ever LAS president of Zambia. I'm so excited to have her here. Linda, welcome to the Saturday morning.
Thank you, Chana. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
We were so excited because we're like, are we really going to get her over? Because I hear you, I see you. Although personally, I haven't seen you for, I think, years.
Yeah.
It took me having to read parts of your book to catch up with the last time we met. And I'm really excited. I feel like, you know, taking us right back to where we were. I think it's probably almost 10 years. I probably haven't really seen you.
Yeah.
And obviously COVID was in the middle of all that. So much has happened as well.
Yeah, sure.
So thank you so much for coming. And from across town, I presume. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, people, they hear about Linda through the eyes of the law and the work that you're doing, and listening to it from a legal perspective and your views and political perspective, to be honest, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to go there today. I want to hear about Linda because I don't really know if people know you like Miss Kasonde. You're Linda in this space and in this room. I want to hear about how you came to be Linda Kasonde. Where did it start? Where were you born? Basic one. Tell me.
Okay, so born right here in Lusaka. Mm-hmm. To
70s baby.
Yes, that's right. Just on the cut, but yes. And born to Joseph and Dorothy Kasonde, yes. Both parents shaped me in different ways. So my dad was the person who sort of pushed the boundaries of possibility. He was always the person who, for example, would look for a car spot where everyone would say, no, I'm sure there's plenty of cars there. You won't find the space, but he'd go there and find it.
Possible.
Yeah.
Let's find it.
Or just adventurous. When we went for holidays, he'd always be driving us around. My mother, on the other hand, is a very sort of practical, pragmatic, careful woman.
Very calm.
Yeah. And I would say that she encouraged my sister and I, Muranga, to become professionals, because she said to us that as women, whatever happens to you, you always have that thing to fall back on. You'll always be that thing. So, as I said, both my parents shaped me in different ways.
I do remember your father being very charismatic.
Mm.
And your mum, who I know very well, is like the calm person. Mm. So probably the combination is exactly what you're describing.
Mm.
So probably a very good result. Because your sister Mvanga studied
economics.
So two lawyers, Mutale, your brother being one, and yourself.
That's right.
And Mutale also being the lead in quite a large legal firm.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a weekend like when you're all sitting around and having a glass of wine? Do you stay away from work or stay away from legal? Or it's really hard, like, let's not do this, let's talk about Netflix.
Well, I'm really an introvert. I like quiet. I like to read or listen to my podcasts. Now that it's cold with a good cup of coffee, and just relax, because the week can be quite hectic.
It is hectic, because I've been seeing and watching you, and obviously your time is very precious, I should imagine, because you're in a commercial space, I have to say, whether you like it or not, and a very demanding space.
Mm-hmm.
So quiet time, private time is really good.
Mm.
So, you know, so your Saturdays, other than being here today, would have been watching your big TV, which I read about in your book. Have you still got it?
I do, actually, yes. Which
a big fat TV.
Well, it's not so much the TV, it was the TV stand. I told the story in my book about how I had it in a box when it was brand new, waiting for someone to help me assemble it. And then I just decided that I was that person.
Who am I waiting for? But you've been writing about this, like, who are we waiting for?
Get on with it. Exactly.
Is it still in the same spot?
No, I've moved house, so I had to move it around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you talk about your, you know, your mother who gave you this empowerment, really, and saying, as women, you need to, if you're going to get married, you're going to have your families, still have your career or something that you can fall back on. You can still decide to be at home, but have something professional that you can fall back on. I think that's pretty much the advice that most women are giving their daughters today. And it leads me into your passion for really educating, guiding, influencing women on your rights, your legal rights, your rights as a person, your human rights. How did you kind of move into that lane from being, yes, a lawyer? And then what led you into that? Is there something you saw when you're a bit younger that said, no, this is not right? And then let me answer that one, and then I've got another one to follow up from there. How did you lead into that?
Interesting. Well, my own view, and I may be wrong, but this is what I think, is that two things shaped me. One was, as a child, I was always the person who stood up for the underdog. For example, if there was a debate around somebody's actions and people were saying they were in the wrong, I would always try and play devil's advocate, particularly if that person wasn't there. So that's something I just had as part of my nature. And then I was taken to a secondary school in Swaziland, which was born out of the anti-apartheid movement. Mm. So we were very much conscientized about justice, racial equality, human rights. Yes. And I think those two things really shaped the person that I became. And then, of course, my parents also always encouraged me to do the right thing. Mm. So just a combination of those different things.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you think that people are confused or need to be counseled on the difference between feminism and kind of guiding women around what their rights are? So I think people might think, you know what, she's a feminist.
Mm. Well, to be honest, I am a feminist, but I don't like to say that because I think it often distracts people from what feminism really is, which is just essentially believing in the equal value of men and women. And of course, we know that women play different roles in society from men often, and that's all permissible within the spectrum of feminism because it's simply allowing people to express themselves as they wish and that they have a choice as to how they express that themselves. So that can mean choosing to stay at home, or it can mean choosing to go to work, or a combination of those things. But the essence of it is that you have the choice. You make the choice.
Right. Yeah. And not being dictated the choice. Feeling that you absolutely don't have a choice.
But
look, that's changing so much now. It's changing rapidly, not just here, but obviously all over the world. And I'd love to, you must have had some feedback locally. I don't listen to all your interviews, and I really would love to. But what sort of feedback do you get from women who are getting influence or encouragement from you? What's the feedback? What do they say? Like, okay, you've opened up my mind, or I didn't know that, or, you know, you've given me the strength to kind of go forward with my career or my life. What have you,
seen? I'm not sure that I see much of that feedback. But I guess I've had people say that my work is inspirational to them. I really think it's about more sort of leading by example than sort of expecting praise for it. I mean, it may come, it may not come. But I simply lead with what I think is the right thing to do. And people can take from that as they wish. But for me, it's all about living life on my own terms.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me about the journey to, you've been asked this, to becoming the president of Mars.
Mm.
There's no way when you were young you would have imagined that. What were your aspirations when you were much younger? What were you thinking to the point that when you got to such an amazing and more amazing roles? It's not, you know, it's not the only one.
Mm.
Tell me what that journey looked like. Probably from your university, because
mm-hmm.
You did that in the UK and in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Okay, well, I think it's fair to say, and you'd probably agree with me, that anyone who knew me as a child would never have guessed that I would end up in the public eye, because I still am, not shy, but introverted, in the sense that I don't necessarily go I'm not looking for spotlight or whatever. I'm just all about expressing myself as fully as I can, and championing the causes that I believe in as an individual. And I think the point at which I changed my views in terms of opting to go into leadership roles was a pivotal moment for me when I was doing my IB, which is like sixth form, the second year of sixth form, the first year. So that year, the Student Representative Council elections were coming around, and one of my classmates asked me if I was going to stand for a position. And I said, no, I don't think anyone's going to vote for me. And he said to me, that's a really lousy attitude. And I just couldn't understand what he was talking about, because I genuinely believed that, you know, elections are essentially a popularity contest, and I didn't think I was very popular. But that conversation set me up many years later to stand for my first last position, which was as an ordinary council member. And when the results came out, I was the third most popular candidate. And I went back to him and I said, wow, look at that. And he hadn't even maybe completely forgotten about that conversation we had. But it really left an impression on me. And from that moment on, I decided, you know, I have something to say. I'm standing for certain causes, and I'm going to put myself out there to champion those causes. So that's really how it started.
Mm-hmm. And now you've had to become comfortable in being in the public eye.
I don't know about comfort, but I see it as a necessary evil, yeah. If you like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for giving us some tips today, which we didn't know about, because we've got more experience than some of us sitting behind the microphone. What at the moment is a cause that's really close to your heart that you want to see, a legal cause, not a cause, that you want to see spoken about a little bit more, or talked about, or dealt with a bit more? What's close to your heart?
So the current issue that I'm focused on at the moment is ensuring that we don't regress as a democracy, because I think at the moment we're heading in the wrong direction. And I know you said you didn't want to specifically go into the details, but democracy as a concept is always potentially under threat anywhere in the world.
Yes,
I mean, we've seen what's happening in the United States, where the current government there is rolling back a lot of rights and privileges that citizens previously enjoyed. And as I say, that can happen anywhere. And it, to some extent, and actually to a great extent, that's happening in our country right now. And I'm very focused on ensuring that it doesn't get to the point of no return, that our democracy is not rolled back, and that we continue on the trajectory of being a beacon of hope on the continent for other democracies who see us as a role model on the continent. Mm. And so that's what I'm really focused on at the moment. And in fact, I'm just about to release a new book,
yes.
It's an anthology, which is a collection of different articles that I've written on the topics of democracy and also being a woman. And my objective is to try and activate people's agency in terms of our democracy, trying to make them see that as an individual, you too can play a role in ensuring that we have human rights, good governance, and democracy in our country, and that the rights of women are respected.
So actually, the democracy goes from big to being democratic in my own space, right?
Absolutely.
So I need to see democracy in my workplace, in my home, and even between you and me.
Absolutely.
I think actually when I look at it, that's where you're supporting women and actually any human being on understanding your democratic rights, whether it's this big or whether it really comes down to you and me or in the home or how I'm treated or how I should be treated.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that everything good in a nation, in terms of the social fabric of a nation, starts at home. And I like to say that women, as the caregivers, the nurturers, actually play the largest role in ensuring that society is fair and just and promotes the good values in our society, and that women essentially have the largest role in ensuring, for example, gender equality or equity, or ensuring that there's little corruption in society, because it starts at home and the values that you impart on your children. Now, when I narrate the story in my book, I add that, yes, I don't have children, but I've been raised by a woman and a man who instilled those values in me, and I saw how critical that was. And so I firmly believe that the role of it starts at home, it starts with that seed.
Do you think we're doing enough as women to support each other? There's a portion of your book which really talks about how we culturally, how we talk to each other and expect their expectations of, no, because you're a woman, this is how you need to deal with this. So do you think somehow we do ourselves some injustice a lot of the time because of our culture? Well, we're not saying, you know, actually, no. This is, but we're reminding ourselves that actually, no, because you're a woman, you're not going to be able to sit forward and do this. And you need to do it like this because culturally, that's how it's done, and that's what's expected of you. So as much as we respect our culture, I'm seeing that at some point it pushes back on what we're on democracy, actually, and actually saying, no, you don't have a seat at this table because you're a woman, and you need to be put on a brave face at every single point.
Well, there are a couple of things there. There's. I'll talk about the brave faced aspect of it, and then I'll speak also about the role that women are expected to play in society. So, for example, women are often told to remain in the background, not to be too vocal, to let the man lead, and these are all things that constrain the full expression of womanhood, and more importantly, impact negatively on our society, because if we're only having men in charge, men leading everything, then the views, perspectives, and lived experiences of women are not incorporated in how we operate as a society. So I like to say that the reason that we need more women in leadership is because we're essentially losing the lived lessons that women have in society and not incorporating them in decision-making in our society. And no better for me is this explained than in a story I tell in my book about a warring faction, and the two sides are fighting over a river on a map. And at the beginning, there's just men in the room. And when women are finally introduced to the conversation, they point out that the river, in fact, had dried up many years ago. And they knew this because women collect water to cook, to clean, you know, as nurturers in the home. Yeah. And if that lived experience had not been brought to the table, then those warring factions would have continued fighting. There was bloodshed simply over something that didn't exist anymore. So that's just a tiny illustration of the many different ways women's lived experiences can be brought to the table to enrich our society. And so it's, I mean, you know, women are often told that they should be the neck turning the head, not the head. Mm. And I think when women are ignored, we suffer as a society. And we don't even see it because, you know, when people are talking about gender equality, people are all about numbers. Like, we need more women at the table. But there's no explanation of why. What will it bring to the table? And so that's what I try and do in my work. Explain the reason why it's important.
So do you think a lot of organizations are really just doing it for the numbers and to be able to say, actually, we have X percent of women in our leadership, but actually not going any deeper than that?
Exactly. And so often it's just one woman at the table.
But we've done our quota.
We've ticked the box. One woman there. But that woman only has one specific kind of experience. When you have more women at the table, in fact, gender equity or equality, then you've balanced the equation and you have a broad spectrum of perspectives.
Different experiences.
Exactly.
And also, I find that it's just a different version of the nurturing. It's a different version of going to get the water and going to cook on the Mbaola. It's a different version of that, but it's actually just bringing the nurturing woman to the table.
Absolutely.
And maybe people just also need to get that out of their societies, need to get that out of their minds. Tell me a good example of either an organization or a country that is doing it really quite well.
I think South Africa is not doing badly in this regard. You have some very powerful women ascending to very powerful positions. I don't like to quote Rwanda, although the numbers are very high of women in governance, but I don't specifically know of any specific examples of women who are doing amazing things there, so I don't like to quote that. But also, I would say Iceland has had a number, I think they've had three different heads of state that have been women, and they seem to be more of an egalitarian society, so that's a great example as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you were at university, going to school, or just really making your path in life, what was one of the things you really hated doing as part of your education? Something you just really didn't want to do, and you just knew that this is not where I need to go. This is who I am. Because I know you've talked about being an introvert. It could be anything. It could be like sport. I hated it. I hated debate. Actually, how were you in debate? You must have been quite. How were you in debate?
I actually never joined any debating teams, amazingly enough. I don't think there was one at our school. Even at university when we had some moot court, which was like debate for lawyers, was an option. And I opted out of it because I was too scared to do it. So really, being out there has been a muscle that I've grown over time. And through necessity, as I mentioned, it's not something that I naturally leaned into. But something I really detested, I think, maybe not so much at high school, but when studying law, both at undergrad and master's level, I really didn't like the commercial subjects. I leaned far more towards the human rights subjects. When I did my master's, I went specifically to get a commercial law specialization. And I ended up doing human rights topics, particularly in my dissertation, because that's where I naturally gravitate towards. And I think I was just really fooling myself that I could be, have that corporate identity when really my heart is really with human rights and the softer, the more social aspects of the law.
There's no us without you, so we say thank you. Starting from the bottom, now we are here. 20, 20, 20.
So even now, what is it that I shouldn't ask you to do if I say, look, we've got a Saturday free. We're gonna go surfing. What should I not ask you to do? What would you just test as a thing outside work?
It would definitely be something that involves big crowds. I really don't like that. A good night out for me is going out to a bar or restaurant with a very calm ambiance
and soft being music. Able to have a conversation.
Exactly, yes.
Oh no, so. You would have been a really bad friend at university.
Indeed.
No.
Actually, I went out a lot at university. That was back in the day. So I do like to dance, so music, but I don't mind clubbing. I didn't mind clubbing at that time. I don't go anymore. But the conversation is very important to me.
Yeah.
Being in a good, have a nice ambience.
We had a guest a couple of months ago, and she dances in her house all the time.
Oh, wow.
So if she's cooking, she says there's music in her house all the time.
Mm.
And now her son, who's probably about, I think he's about 10, he's caught on to that. So she's constantly dancing, and they video themselves dancing. And she's out on TikTok and all sorts of things. So would I catch you dancing at home?
Maybe in my kitchen. That's as far as it goes. I've just stopped that whole, I've retired now.
And cooking what, may I ask? What is the one thing you wanna like, I'm gonna get up and do this. I'm gonna go and buy the ingredients. I'm dying for this. What's the one thing that you do and do well?
I like a good curry. I do a good lasagna. Very boring things. I'm not like a foodie, but I cook I cook good wholesome food. Particularly in winter. I like soups and things like that. So but in terms of Zambian foods that I can't resist, I would say the foods that you get this time of year. So boiled maize, boiled groundnuts, kandoro, sweet potato. So those are my staples of this time of the year with a good cup of tea.
Gosh. Yeah. That's great. And I'm sure you're one of those people who, even if it's on the side of the road, you're like, I'm going to stop. I'm not going to get one.
Actually, my mother has instilled in the fear of
cholera. Getting,
yeah, exactly. Yes. So no.
Or otherwise, you don't tell her. And she's like, no, it's from home. So with your leadership roles, so many again, you must have faced so many barriers, but you must have made a deliberate mental had a deliberate mental strategy maybe on how you're going to deal with the barriers, but they must have been so many. Maybe two that you can think of that kind of said, look, I'm in this leadership role and I know I'm going to face these barriers, or this is typically what's going to come to me. I know that you've mentioned a situation there when you came back to work and somebody expected you to resign. That kind of barrier. Maybe it's expectations from either the other gender or just from somebody else. Let me ask this differently. What would your advice be to somebody who is in a leadership role or is planning to be in one or heading there in order to just make sure that they fight those barriers, not even fight, or they manage those barriers? They could be anything, to be honest.
Well, I'll start by saying that I've been very deliberate in my leadership journey. So, for example, I decided I wanted to become the last president a good 7 years in advance and worked my way to the point at which I could stand by taking up roles that interested me, volunteering in many different committees and things like that, and just putting myself out there. And I do think it's important to be deliberate in your leadership or your career journey, because we have too many accidental leaders, particularly in the political sphere. You know, I'm also a very big Oprah Winfrey fan, and she always talks about thinking about what your intention is, being very intentional about what you want to do and having a value placed at the heart of that intention.
Mm.
So I totally subscribe to that view. And I guess that's what I would say to anybody who wants to pursue any kind of journey. What is your intention? What do you want to achieve and why? And for me, as an individual, I believe in following your purpose. And so these are all things that guide me.
So even in your, so is your next book, what's the intention of the next book? The, you said it's a collation, but
the intention, particularly around the democracy piece, is to highlight the importance of why we need to maintain democratic values as a nation, and also to encourage people who might say to themselves, I can do something about this, and then take the next step towards doing something about it. And just for us as a nation to reflect on the journey we have pursued from independence to date, to remind us of the good things we've done along the way. For example, I always, the whole third term debate during President Chiluba's time was a huge victory for Zambians, because I think at the time he was in office, he basically had a two-thirds majority in parliament, and so could easily have changed the constitution to give himself that third term. But because the advocacy, the groundswell of civil society, the church, the trade unions, everybody came together to ensure that that didn't happen and pushed back, we ultimately escaped becoming essentially what would have become a dictatorship.
Yes.
And these moments in time come up time and time again. And so it's important for us as people,
in different ways.
Yes, yeah. To remind ourselves of our power as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a huge history fan of history. It's because there's nothing new under the sun, as they say, biblically. And so it's important to know your history so that you can learn from it and use the tools from the past in the future.
I've also seen you quoting from the Bible and using the Bible as a mentoring part of your being.
Mm.
Tell me about your religion.
So,
what role it plays for you?
So, I like to say I'm Catholic by identity, but I'm Christian in the broad sense. So over my lifetime, I've been to various churches to experience Christianity in different ways. And I always try and look for the Christ, the biblical Christ, as opposed to the dogmatic Christ. Because Christ, in many ways, was, it's not that he was a rebel. Just speaking the truth was a rebellious act, because so often people try and shy away from the truth. Because it's hard. It's really hard to stand on principle all the time,
so consistently. Do you think people look at you as a bit of a rebel?
I think they do. It does surprise me that they think I'm controversial, which always surprises me, because I just think I'm trying to do the right thing, but somehow that's so difficult for people to understand, to stand on principle. And that's all it is. I'm not necessarily just trying to be seen or be heard. It's really about standing in my truth. And so for me, Christ is the highest example of that. And I aspire to be Christ-like. That's what it means to be a Christian.
And so you can maybe see it from the perspective of course, Christ suffered for us because he was telling the truth and doing the right thing, as you and me would know it. So I guess in your role, you are trying to do the right thing and might be seen as being rebellious, being political, essentially just making a lot of noise to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you're good with that, because as far as you're concerned, I'm trying to do the right thing.
Well, it for me, it's the cost of pursuing truth and purpose. You're not going to be liked by everyone, and you've just got to be okay with that. Even though it is difficult, it can be very difficult at times, because often you don't fit in nicely to society's constructs, one of who a woman should be, and in other respects. Part of my work is sort of corporate, so there are various things that don't sit nicely in any neat box. And so you get used to being seen as someone who's sort of, they call them tall poppies. Somebody who stands out, not stand out, but sticks out, in the sense that you're not conforming to everyone around you. Mm. And you've just got to be comfortable with that and find spaces and people who align with you. Otherwise, it can be very difficult.
Do you think your law firm would suffer from, you know, your standing at all?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yes, it actually does. I know that there are clients that I can never get, yes, because I'm perceived in a particular
but
way.
But you're okay with that.
That's the cost.
Yeah. So we'll go back to religion. So do your Sundays look like, do they vary from, today I feel like going to church, or actually no, I just listen on the radio, or I'll listen to a podcast that's inspirational, or I'll listen to Oprah and get my inspiration from there. And that is a Christ-like thing for me to do. It doesn't, I'm sure it's not typical.
That's right.
Yeah.
Although I do know that going to church is important, but there's a phrase I came across in my Bible, which I like to use as an excuse for not being so consistent in my church going, but that there are some Christians who are so heavenly minded that they're of no earthly good. And so very pious in their views as to what being a good Christian means, that they lose sight of what Christ was all about. And not to sound like I'm a perfect Christian, I'm certainly not, but often I find it difficult to deal with some of those views.
And that's a really, that quote can be actually taken in so many different contexts, from a global country, and again, can be shrunk so much, where people have overly thought themselves, that they just cannot see what really matters, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Can be at any level. I like
absolutely
that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the almost 50, but we're past that now.
Mm.
But the midlife, I don't want to call it midlife crisis. You talk about a little bit about being nervous in your book before turning 50 and what that mark looked like.
Mm.
I think the pressure of turning 50 was there. It's not there anymore. But I'm going to look back when you were writing this. You kind of talked about the turning 50 and the mess, the 50 mess.
I am on the cusp of turning 50, a couple of years to go, but I'm not worried about it at all. I've had literally a couple of experiences that have been life-threatening, and so I just view the gift of life as being so precious, and I'm excited for the future. I'm excited to turn 50. And my role model for this is always with Oprah Winfrey, because she continues to evolve. She continues to find new ways of giving expression to life, which I find very inspiring. Mm. Yes, so that's my motivation. And I look forward to whatever 50 will bring. is sometimes called the messy middle because it's at this stage where you've got aging parents. For those with kids, you're dealing with both aging parents and younger children. So it can be tricky in that respect. And also, the world is often very ageist. So it's also a time at which you're aging out of certain opportunities.
Yeah.
But there's also opportunity in reaching those milestones.
Oh, there's the experience.
Exactly.
To be really honest.
Yes.
I was speaking to a friend of mine who's having a tough time because she's, and I've talked about this on the show as well, she's employing millennials.
Mm.
And she's like, they're coming in and out of the door like anything.
Mm.
And she goes, I just need a reliable personal assistant.
Mm.
So she went and hired a retired secretary who was like loyal, would be there, was no excuse for not being at work, got the job done, even if there was no real conversation.
Mm.
So there is light and there is good in being on the other side and value to experience, which comes with so many things. There's the respect, there's the maturity, seeing things on both sides. I mean, I think it's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's great. So we look forward to that part of that part of your journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure your next book will be ready well before that.
I was going to say that I'm actually releasing it in about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Well, by the time this show airs, it will be out, I think.
And where do we get hold of it, please?
Probably it'll be available in local bookstores, sure. Maybe Amazon, but I'll let people know.
I need Oprah to put it up as one of put it up in her book of the month. I saw her last week and she was picked up the phone to Tina Knowles.
Mm.
And it was just such an amazing, obviously I haven't read it, but it was such an amazing moment. Like you say, she reinvents herself and helps reinvent the mind for people as she goes. Look at that, a story of somebody who's 70 plus, she's also reinvented herself or told her story. But the way she puts it across, you feel inspired. I want to read it and be inspired. So I'm positive that I'll be inspired by your book when I read it.
I hope so.
Yeah, and I'm going to probably just ask you to keep reinventing yourself because I think we must in your several amazing, amazing roles. And I think I'd be amiss if I didn't touch on your experience where you're a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind me talking about that? Yeah, because I found that, honestly, when I read your book, I found that extremely emotional, meaningful, so many messages about so many things. And I think the touching moment for me was how actually you're such a great leader and showing leadership, but you're so powerless or must have felt powerless in so many ways from not knowing what's happened or from everything happening to then not knowing what's happened and being no control where people have taken control of you actually.
Mm-hmm.
Giving you injections that you were having a horrible effect on you, and you had no option.
Mm. Mm.
So for me, that was so poignant and so brave of you to talk about that. Even if it's years on, it must really be so painful to talk about. I can't even ask what lessons from there or what did you learn from there because it's so much. Maybe just to give me a summary of that episode, from whichever angle from you, just briefly. I don't want you to talk about it too much. I don't want to, this is so emotional. But how would you summarize that episode in your life and maybe what it's done for you now and what you took away from that actually?
Mm. So just for the audience, Chana's referring to a part of my book where I talk about losing a child. Shortly after childbirth, So I had an emergency C-section at 28 weeks, and the baby didn't survive. And I really wanted to talk about that experience from the perspective that culturally, the loss of a child, particularly as an infant, is seen as something that women should just bounce back from and not really truly have time to mourn properly. Exactly. Yeah. You have stories have been told to me of people who haven't been told where their child is buried, or just told to have another child because it's the
feelings,
just a sense of that it's your child is replaceable. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was important to talk about that and to give voice to so many women who don't have that voice, who are not allowed to express that grief or to process it even. And for me, you asked me what I learned from the experience. I think it was also something eye-opening for me in the sense that so many women automatically expect that when they are pregnant, they will deliver a healthy child. So for me, it opened me to the side that where things don't turn out well. And also for me, because when I was in that condition, I was advocating for myself as a patient. I knew what medications I was taking. I asked questions of my doctors. And in fact, it was the fact that I was able to ask questions of the doctors that saved my own life, because I believe that the first doctor I had would have killed me, essentially, because I didn't know what was going on. So I continued to do my personal research through Googling, and that helped me ask the right questions, make sure I received the right care. So all of those things. And then, unfortunately, here, you often have to have somebody by your bedside to also help you advocate, because obviously you're in a vulnerable physical situation. So it opened my eyes to that side of things. And when I looked at the statistics of maternal and child mortality in Zambia, I found them very shocking.
Yes.
Because we're not doing enough to take care of our mothers and our children. And so for me, it was also an advocacy point to say that children and mothers are not disposable, and we need to find ways of ensuring that they both live. And so there were many different aspects to that experience that I wanted to highlight.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for sharing that. Very few people would.
Yeah.
And I hope it inspires other people to do what you have in terms of advocate for yourself and your child if you can. But we all know that the majority cannot, and you don't hear about a number of these deaths or situations because people still can't speak up for themselves.
Mm.
If I'm in the middle of a village somewhere, it's just this happened.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Yeah. Thank you so much for speaking up. Mm. There's a question I'm dying to ask you, because with everything you've done, and at such an amazing age, to be honest, yet to be 50, great achievements, but there must have been a time where you just said, forget it, I'm packing up and I'm going, I'm not doing this. When was that, and what was it?
So I'm not somebody who believes that you should never quit. But I think there's a time and place for doing so. So for example, many people wonder why I didn't quit the presidency of Lance, because it was so trying and difficult. For me, in that particular experience, having been the first woman elected to that position was my primary consideration. But I couldn't set the example that women can't do this. And so for me, finishing my term was critical. And so I did. Because, you know, it's now out there. People can see that a woman can perform this role, even in difficult circumstances. But for example, I resigned from my position as a named partner at the law firm I was previously at. And for me, the consideration was that I wanted to pursue my purpose, which I believe was to set up Chapter One Foundation to pursue the goals of championing human rights, rule of law, and democracy in the country. So I did quit then. And then 5 years after starting Chapter One, I also left that position because I wanted to focus more on me. As an individual, as a person who has their own goals and ambitions, after having given so much of myself to that role. So like I said, I believe in the pivot. I'm all for it. Like I said earlier, we continue to evolve in many different ways. And the goal should always be about achieving the highest, fullest expression of yourself.
So it wasn't quitting out of, I can't do this. It wasn't quitting out of frustration and, you know, I'm off, this is too much. It was quitting for the better of either myself, the better of the purpose that I have, or actually, in the case of your law firm, probably even the better for the law firm. So, well, that's great to know that it wasn't in a frustrated situation of, I'm a giver, you're not a giver up, clearly, as you said. So that's really good to know. On that note, Linda, I want to thank you so much for coming to be with us at Inkwazi.
Thank you.
And I think you can, I'll leave you to go back to your coffee and your TV and Oprah. If you're going to quit, you quit for purpose.
There's no us without you, so we say, baby.